You're listening to Brand Enabled, the human stories behind branding. This is the place to gain greater insight into the human side of branding. Join Gabriel Cohen as he sits down with branding experts, sharing real-life stories of how they faced complex issues along their journey. Learn how others are dealing with maximizing the power of brand and get valuable advice straight from your peers. Here's your host, Gabriel Cohen.
Welcome to today's episode. Really excited here to be with Slate Olson, who's the Chief Marketing Officer of Lodge, which is an outdoors brand, which is really disrupting the category. We're going to be talking a lot about his really interesting past as well, because he spent 10 years at Nike in a couple of different stints. For anyone who is at all interested in cycling, this is a must-listen to episode, because he was also the CMO of one of the most loved bike brands in the world, Specialized, if you hadn't already guessed. So welcome to the show, Slate.
Thank you very much. It's fantastic to be here and great to see you.
And I got to say, you know, people always talk about, you know, a lot of times these days when we're on camera so much, for people who are listening to this on the podcast, I mean, you have to go and check it out, the actual YouTube video, but you've got an amazing background behind you. There are a couple of things behind there that we should know about that have a great story behind them.
Thank you. Yes, I you can also see above me. I actually sit in my basement here in in the Pacific Northwest. I'm based in Northeast Portland, but yeah, definitely a few of my favorite things. I've got Theo Gegenhardt, who's a lovely, incredible professional cyclist now. His he won the Giro d'Italia I guess going on 3 years ago, so he was very, very kind and gave that to me. And then let's see what else is back there. Lauren Fleshman, one of my favorite athletes and human beings I've ever had the pleasure of working with, didn't help. She came back after we presented a concept to her and said, "That's terrible. What if we did something better?" And it ended up in being a really sort of infamous or famous piece of work called Objectify Me about women's running. And then I think just behind me, my hero since I was a kid and still today, Steve Prefontaine, just with regards to not only how he ran, but what he stood for. And then I think the last thing is the Suffer license plate, which when I was at Rafa, that became our license plate that we had in our, one of our North American vehicles, and ended up making t-shirts around it and all of that, which Rafa's strap line was glory through suffering. And if anybody here has ridden a bike, then you know that the beauty is actually not just in cycling, but in a lot of things. There's a lot of suffering that ends to whatever version of glory you discern, you know, you can determine. So a few favorite things, probably a bit more. Yeah.
And it's been a really interesting couple of weeks for US cycling, right? With an American winning the Vuelta in Spain. It's probably the first time in a long time.
It's been a while. There's been some other Americans who have done well at the Vuelta, but a Colorado kid, Sepp Kuss, who's in, you know, is typically, if anybody watches a Tour de France, you'll see him doing all of the work for, you know, his team leader. And so for him to get the chance to go out and actually get that result for himself is incredible and super human being again. And I have a lot of love for cyclists and road cyclists, especially at the pro, because it is as brutal of an existence as, you know, it can be with regards to what they have to do is to train and to how they watch calories and then go out and perform. I had a quote once, I think it's out there, like from a cyclist who was like, "You got to eat like a bird and shit like an elephant." And I always thought that was a pretty perfect way of summarizing it. So definitely epitomize suffering.
So I think a lot of the theme of today's conversation is going to be about disruption. And we're going to go on a tour of Slate's career. Hopefully it won't be as brutal as painful as a climb up Alpe d'Huez.
Yes. No, my, you know what? I, Thanks for asking. I've had a lot of fun so far in the grand scheme of things. It's not that work is always fun. I think anybody who says that, whenever I hear the words or the term living the dream, I always wonder what kind of dreaming people are doing. But I started out in San Francisco Bay Area in advertising and then brand consulting, and then made my way up to Nike for the first time, where I came in through really like retail marketing and eventually worked in the advertising group, which had a few different iterations and names, working across a number of parts of the business. Left after 7 years to take a little flyer for this upstart company called Rafa that at the time was hardly in existence in North America, but starting, you know, it was clearly very special with regards to what they were doing. And so I spent 7 years at Rafa, which was included leading North America, growing and building that, and then took my family and I to London, where I had a chance to work really closely with Simon Mottram as the CMO of Rafa. And then ultimately, you know, there's a deeper story to it, but felt this urge to get back to the States and get back to the West Coast. And so did that with Specialized, working with Mike Senyard. And as you mentioned, absolutely an iconic and deservedly so brand. And so that was a really exciting time. I love Mike Senyard. I actually love the brand. But ultimately, I pulled my wife off of her track, and she's a physician. And so the sort of pining for the Pacific Northwest and for her to be able to get back onto her train required that we needed to get back into the Portland area. So a couple quick years with Chrome Industries, running that as the president, and a great little turnaround conversation that we could have. And then ultimately, you know, just sort of realize that what I wanted to do and what, you know, the owner wanted to do might not always be in alignment and for where the brand and the business could go. And so I had a conversation with an old friend that took me back to Nike for a few years and left. And what are we at now? 23, early 22, took some time. And that's where I found myself of November of 22 at Lodge Camps, where I'm running brand and marketing. So that's the quick version, as quick as I can do, being of kind of how I got here and what I'm doing.
So let's talk about the Nikes, because it was really interesting that there are about 12 years difference between your first tour of duty and the second tour of duty. So it'd be really interesting to talk about the Nike that you were in those early days, and then how much things had changed in the second one. And I think especially because a lot of people are, I think everyone's seen the movie Air, so people are really curious, just a lot of curiosity about the story. Because probably when you were there at the, what state were things at when you were there?
Early 2000s. I think there's a couple different ways you could classify it, but it was, you know, it was a company that when I came in, like the stock was kind of at a lower level. I think I was hired during a hiring freeze, but the potential was there. And it was an interesting time because some of the categories that had historically delivered well, basketball, back to air, you know, were under attack from brands like And One, you know, which was really kind of coming in. Under Armour was just really starting to be a reality from a base layer standpoint. There were a lot of, you know, kind of, you'll call them old timers, who, you know, were lamenting a little bit the change of the company. I think at the time, the Beaverton headquarters were like 3,000 people. But it still felt like it had, you know, there was some stalwarts there from the heyday of Nike advertising, for example, that were incredible leaders. You kind of fast forward that gap, and, you know, then suddenly you have, I think, 14 or 16,000 people on the headquarter campus. The things that I saw as I was departing in kind of early 08, starting to be created with regards to organization and sort of where strategic management, kind of brand management, were starting to challenge at least the process. And so when I came back 11 years and I came into a different group working with the NFL and Major League Baseball and high school and team sports, there were a lot of things that felt very similar, very comfortable. And there were a number of things that had really just evolved and had become sort of this machine in and to itself that felt like it was a bit, it was certainly new. And I think for a company of that size, I think, you know, it was going from, I think it was $16 billion, give or take, in 2008, my numbers may be off, to 40 plus billion 11 years later. And so obviously that doesn't just happen with a bit of luck and ingenuity. That happens with a lot of things like process and planning and all of that, which is critical. And sometimes, you know, could feel a little bit at odds for the creative genius that I think, you know, Nike's always had with from a marketing standpoint. But at the end of the day, I grew up around the brand. I still to this day love and will argue for the brand in a lot of different ways. And you know, when you have a relationship like that, there's goods and bads that come with that, right? And it's just in the spirit of change.
So on that topic of process, one of the things I've always admired a lot about Nike is you have this sort of singular brand that has a very clear purpose and story around it, yet the execution in different sports, if you compare women's running to tennis to golf to more urban sport, like you said, like basketball, everything still feels like it's connected to a core story, yet the execution's very different. How do they take us under the hood? How are they able to achieve that mix of decentralization while still laddering up to a core in such a big organization?
It's definitely an incredible strength, and it's, you know, for sure not always perfect. I'll say that. And especially if you think about, you know, kind of what's happening at world headquarters, and then as it starts to branch out, right? And you think about what's going on in Asia Pacific or otherwise, they really, you know, do and should be of and for kind of the communities and cultures that they're a part of. And so you've got that layer, and then you start to layer on the different sports, right? Or the different activities. You know, if it sounds like there's thousands of people, it's because there are thousands of people that kind of go from the beginning and origin, working all the way upstream with the product teams. And so, you know, from an insight or an innovation, and shepherding that through a pretty lengthy cycle, because it, you know, it's 2 to 3 years or more in a lot of cases when you start with a concept on a product to when it will hit market. And so along the way, you know, the process is really pretty phenomenal, and it's been built to continue to build and socialize and share. And I'm going to talk a little probably more about, like, from a product standpoint, there's a lot of other things that Nike does really well that also needs to connect. But I think the genius in some ways is kind of, and it's painful at times, but that process and the pass through and handover and pass down allows people to inject either new ideas or see things in a different way. And then allows you to, you know, to kind of take what has been constant through the kind of origin and then start to add different layers or tuck into certain areas in its own right. What makes it tricky sometimes, if you think everybody's working against the same, you know, proper goal, right? Which is this notion of kind of unlocking human potential and serving the athlete. And, you know, if you know the athlete has an asterisk at Nike, like if you have a body, you're an athlete. And so it's not just about the pinnacle of performance, it's everyone. And so when you start to kind of go into categories, running or basketball or tennis, you know, there are really clear, specific insights and that are those audiences, that are those communities, but it still has to feel like Nike. And there's some incredible thinkers and designers and creators that kind of constant vigilance and in the process every quarter or every year, as you start to roadmap that, you can do your best to sort of see where you're going to keep your category voice and what those insights and specifics are. And then where are those moments that need to kind of ladder up, those global moments? And like Women's World Cup's a great example. How is every category going to have some connection? Because that's what Nike, you know, really standing for football or soccer. And for women, what's the way that's going to connect? And so we look for ways that you can, in essence, contribute and participate. And in other ways where you need to keep your voice 365, because that's one of the probably the biggest and easiest ways that people can complain about Nike is because it's ubiquitous. And it's not it's not a running specialty company. That's where I go to Brooks, or that's where I go because you guys make X, X, and X. You're not serious for me. And I think that's always been a challenge and remains a challenge for a brand like Nike, who's just that large and everywhere. So
you take running as an example, right? You mentioned this when we were talking earlier, that real runners don't actually run in Nike.
That's often the complaint. And it's funny because you've got, you know, on the world stage, the best runners and athletes in the world, Nike, right? And we saw other sponsored athletes who would wear Nike spikes. And then there's this notion that, oh, if you're a real runner, you might start in Nike because you go to your local sporting goods shop. But once you get more serious, part of the, again, this is more fed back to us, or was, is that, oh, that's when you go to an Ultra, or you go to, a Brooks, or you go to a only running footwear company. And I think that's something that Nike's had to battle for a long time.
Which is a classic brand challenge in any category. You think about the pure player niche or the ankle biter who comes in compared to the brand that tries to serve a lot of different categories.
And I think, you know, that's really the spectrum is challenging. And so while you know, Nike, I think, does a really good job of being for all people, sometimes that dilution, you know, allows certain parts of that to feel like, well, then you're not serious enough for, for me. And I think I have run in other products in my lifetime, and once was kind of through a shop in San Francisco sponsored by ASICS. But still today, I think, you know, I would challenge people. I would call myself a historically serious runner. And I love what Nike's made. Not everything. And I think that's part of it too, is how do you kind of get grace for the missteps you make that might not be quite there. But I think that also in specialized ties into it. When you're pushing innovation, you're bound to make some things that don't quite hit the mark. But I do think that's the part that's also really interesting. And we used to talk about this a lot. If I was overseeing running for my last little bit, if my job is to bring runners and have Nike be really sort of connected to and serious, I always thought about it like a house party. And so my job with multiple doors, my job was to bring the runners in to the Nike house party, if you will, while, you know, one of my colleagues was bringing in the basketball folks, but we were all bringing them to the house of Nike. And because there were so many different ways, from lifestyle to sport to cross training to whatever the case may be, that, you know, it was kind of our collective job to make sure they stayed, right? They stayed at that party for the majority of their kind of life or sport interactions. And that's always been kind of my view for a company of that size. And that's why my running door would look different than your basketball door or your tennis door. But they should all kind of come together and feel like, oh, this is where I belong. Let me go explore X, X, and X. Because as much as people say there's, you know, one thing, people are multiple dimensions.
I think that's a super interesting analogy. You know, bring people in through the different doors and ensuring that they stay, because then you might decide to go and explore a new sport, and then you already have that base awareness, and you'll go and I have a Nike tennis shirt and a Nike golf shirt, and I had Nike cleats when I was still young enough to play soccer.
And I think it gets back to your main question, which is like, so if the brand and the promise of the brand through product, through reverence or irreverence is at least connected enough, you can see the thread, and then you allow yourself the chance to put a little bit of distinction across, because a runner is not a basketball player, even though, you know, they may play basketball. There's just a different mindset that I think people approach their activity or sport.
And internally, especially when you left, when you were there in the last couple of years, was the structure done in a way, and the processes in a way where if you're working on running, that if you then went over to basketball to another area, it'd be a smooth transition, very much like in the same way that like a P&G does it, right? Where if you're trained as a brand manager, you're actually expected to go and shift between brands every few years. I don't know if there's the same expectation, like in order to be able to move up, but at least at P&G, you can definitely work on, you work on different brands because they all have this, they all have a very similar a brand management approach, regardless of the difference in the category.
Very, very similar, I think. And so you are encouraged and allowed opportunities to kind of work across to continue to grow, whether it's in different categories. And again, I think there's also kind of the gender conversation, which, you know, in the last few years, Nike's kind of gone from the category to gender. And I think they're, as I understand, they're kind of, I don't know if they've announced it necessarily or will ever announce it, but they realize like you got to start with the sport or the category. But, you know, obviously certain people bring experience, insights, and a passion, and they want to stay in a certain, you know, group like running forever. And I think, you know, that's definitely something that does happen, but more often than not, people get a chance to grow new skills and into different areas. And the path to that is made easier by the fact that it is kind of working off the same, you know, the same strategy and approach. So schedules change and what's important and how many athletes you have, you know, is very different if you're in basketball than if you're in, say, running and how you use them. Because the social kind of spillover is really different, right? And so, I don't know, a lot of people would, you know, Kipchoge is one of the world's greatest athletes, right? Just won in Berlin recently again, but doesn't have the same sort of probably general cachet that, I don't know, Kevin Durant does. So that gives you a chance to use and build plans in a much different way, but off the same foundation.
What sort of unique things does, you know, someone who's been at Nike for a while as a marketer, what are some of the sort of unique skill sets that they carry forward with them to the rest of their lives? Like, I always found that there are some commonalities, again, I'll reference back to P&G, you know, you learn to talk about the first and second moment of truth. And so regardless of where you go, you sort of take that. I'm sort of oversimplifying, but are there certain unique characteristics of a Nike marketer?
I think so. I think it's probably changing a little bit now. And it certainly, I would, you know, Slate in 2008 would have told you a different answer than nowadays. Probably the biggest thing, I still think that there is, even though sometimes it might feel like it's been a bit diminished, there still is this idea of like absolute ingenuity and creativity that is prevalent across. And so I think that's something that's still really sought, a genuine deep passion for sort of that never been done moment or doing things in a totally new way. So I think that's something that I, you know, I still hold really in value of like what I learned at Nike. I think the other thing that is probably a little bit more like P&G nowadays is the structure and the process and the kind of operational way of thinking across a massive, you know, there's a number of groups, whether it be digital or, you know, obviously creative and the list goes on and on. And so I think that ability to kind of from a leadership standpoint, really strong in strategy and approach, and then being able to manage kind of a chorus of voices to get to, you know, something that ultimately has the intended effect is something I think is super important. And again, it all starts with that, you know, absolute smart and clear point of view on what, you know, what the objective was or what the approach was going to be, and then navigating that. And so I think, you know, if I were being critical, which I can be sometimes, and I would have, even if I were still there, I think sometimes the machine has gotten in to become more of the importance than the actual sort of marketing. And that's, you know, it's one of the things that I think is obviously a positive, because it's allowed, as we talked about earlier, the company to and brand to continue to drive and grow. But maybe a little bit of what Nike originally was, which was, you know, rebellious and irreverent and all of that, can sort of maybe not be as inspired, or, you know, be inspired or asked for in the same way nowadays. That's bound to happen, right?
You were talking about ingenuity and doing things that had never been done before. Is that something that you learn? Is that a process? What is that?
It was historically, it was actually something that would, you know, when you went in to brief a season or a new launch, it would be something that would be actually a KPI, right? Can we do something that we would call an NBD? Never been done. And again, it's very hard to do something that's truly never been done. But, you know, if you can do something that's obvious but done in a completely different way, I think that was great. So we would set that out as a challenge as you started. And so, and again, I think a lot of times those are easy for the taking if you just have the right kind of insight back from, you know, the space or from, you know, the athlete or the consumer. So that's definitely one that, you know, that I learned early days and I still hold on to. How can we do this totally different?
Well, what do you think some of the secret behind some of the brands who have come into this space as disruptors in incredibly highly what is a highly competitive category? I mean, whether we're talking about a Hoka, which, as I know, a brand that you love, the one for me that I've been amazed about, but I don't know much about the story, is On, which all of a sudden I'm now starting to see them in already expanding into other sports like tennis.
Yeah, with Roger.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's incredible, right? You think that there can't be any more. And then, you know, I don't know if it's the advent of the internet, but it's crazy to watch brands come out with something new. And in On's case, I mean, On, you know, they've had a very good year, as I understand, just kind of following along. The growth has been pretty incredible. And it's funny because we used to joke, again, back in the old days of And One and Under Armour, that like any company can get to 100 million, but it's that gap to a billion, which is, you know, which is really kind of the difference. And you know, On, I think it really comes from design, and in a large part, like, they created something totally different. As I understand it, you know, their midsole was really created as they were looking at cutting a garden hose, right? And so they're like, oh, the cushioning idea from that was initially based off of a garden hose. And then they just kind of came out, and a little bit of a slow roll at first, right? Because you just come off Hoka to some degree, where Hoka had these huge chunky midsoles, and they, you know, obviously are still doing well and they make great product. And so the freshness and design and kind of innovation from On was something that captured people's imagination. They had to see it, and then they made good design choices, and still are, with regards to color palettes and kind of the upper design. And so I think that you really started to see this brand come from, you know, where most things come from: a great product, an interesting product with a unique story, with, you know, its European kind of storylines and heritage. And then they are building out good decisions with athletes, good decisions by, you know, partnering with Roger Federer. And we'll, you know, maybe someday get said the same thing that Nike gets told, like, oh, you make all of these things, how are you still a serious running brand? Would be a good problem, I imagine, that they would have as they transcended into lifestyle and all of that. So there's still room. It's funny. Still new ideas.
How important is that? Is that athlete voice and that in the product development and I guess maintaining the authenticity? Because it's almost the original category when you think about co-creation.
Right. I think it's essential. I think it's, you know, something that I've also, you know, starting with the voice of the consumer is another adage, which I've taken from, you know, my time along the way. And so whether it's working with the world's greatest athletes, right, world record holders in the 100, again, not everything translates into the everyday sort of use, but like, there's something in that that will. It might just be a little idea on fit or idea on accessibility. So I think it's critical. I think if, you know, I often think about what our job is to do is to start at the consumer, take it back to product, and then we manage kind of like an ocean rising and falling, right? Like if we start with something true, that's a need or a want or an opportunity, navigate it through the system of or the company, and then find a way to bring that back in a fresh new way, then I think, you know, that's tends to be, I think, where we see a lot of more success. Sometimes it starts purely with, we have this new X, this new foam or this new technology. And then you kind of go and almost start the process from there. Then you've got to go there, back. But yeah, when those insights, and that's, you know, that's a group of people from designers and product managers who are just out speaking to people from, you know, everydayers to the world's best, and sort of do the best you can to serve the needs.
So let's move over to Specialized then as a brand, mm-hmm. because that's where you go from this behemoth across all these other categories to now mm-hmm. You're using Brooks as an example. Would it be fair to say mm-hmm. almost more of like a Brooks style brand in that known for a single thing. Talk a bit about what you went into do at Specialized and even yeah. a bit of background on the Specialized brand. Like, how did it become this iconic brand in the category? Yeah. Like, why is it so loved?
Yeah, no, I'll, so I went, you know, from Nike, which again at the time was like 3,000 of my closest friends, to Rafa for 7 years, which when I started, I was employee 11 and there was three of us in North America. And I think coming to Specialize, and it was a really abrupt decision, because I went from a brand, you know, clearly brand and kind of storytelling to Specialize, which had always been known for innovation. I think they're, you know, and still today, innovate or die is one of their main, you know, mantras within the company. But I think that really, you know, Mike Senyard started that back in 71, and he started by bringing over European products and accessories, and then realized he could add something to it and create better. And so that innovative spirit has existed forever. I think, you know, as they started to build and scale, and you look at competitors like Trek and Giant, great, you know, great brands, massive. Giant is humongous if you look at their total umbrella. You know, Specialized continued to show force through, you know, really looking after retail partners and expanding through that. As, you know, brands like Canyon came direct to consumer, I think Specialized strength in a lot of ways, which, you know, could also sometimes be seen as a weakness, was that they were so embedded with, you know, your local bike shop and with the right ones. And so that was it. I think what Specialized was working through is like, beyond product, how do we make this a, you know, brand that people truly love, right? So they and sort of almost an insurance policy for when there's a comparable bike at a lesser price that has all the same components, then do you really, you know, do you love the S or not? And so what were the different things that we could kind of add to, yes, we make great product, but we also make X, or we do this and we're involved here. And our voice is, you know, is kind of growing as consumer trends weren't at the time. Adventure, gravel cycling was, you know, was definitely still continuing to, and it's still rising now, but like, how could we play, you know, a role in adventure while we're still winning Tour de France with Peter Sagan? But how do we dimensionalize Peter Sagan in a way that is exciting and fresh versus, you know, otherwise? And so that was probably in large part what, you know, what I was trying to do. And then, you know, within the industry, I brought enough of like an outside point of view, even though I just spent, you know, I worked on Nike Cycling, I'd been at Rafa, But sort of just this idea of like, if, you know, if you want to be a beloved, larger company, bigger brand, then there are some different ways that both internally and externally that I think we needed to show up. And so that's really what I think I came to do and set out to do while I was there.
So, when you're in a category like that, you start to look at expansion. Do you start to dig into maybe different use cases? How do you begin to sort of look at segmenting and stratifying the market in order to drive growth?
No, it's a great question. Really, I mean, in some ways, similar to even the Nike, right? You've got mountain bikers, you have triathletes, you have road cyclists, you've got everyday cyclists who are, you know, commuting to and from. And so you started to kind of, in those categories, you would look at them, again, really, really similar to the conversation we had around Nike. Like, what are those areas of opportunity where, you know, somebody can be in love with, you know, how they first came in, right? I came in as a road cyclist, but then I started racing cyclocross, and that turned me into, you know, I dabbled in mountain biking, and I may still first choose road, but I think expanding kind of the garage was a really similar approach. And then, you know, again, I think Specialized is probably best known for bikes for sure, but if like, from a helmet standpoint and even shoes and garment, like there was so much that was for offer. And in a really similar way, you know, sometimes the big red S, you know, was getting picked apart by the little guys who were only doing this or didn't have the weight maybe behind it. And so that was a constant conversation with retail partners and with our sales team is like, how do we make big for good? And big can be really for good, especially when that means you can put bigger money into innovation. So, you know, building a wind tunnel, your own private wind tunnel on your campus allowed you to get that much quicker to deliver results for athletes of all types, right? And cyclists of all measure. So that was really the approach that we took. Sorry if I just wandered off on that one.
Absolutely answered it. Because I was never sure whether it was a good strategy. For example, I took my kids to a bike shop, you know, when they were six to buy their first bike, you know, a Specialist bike. And I thought it was interesting because on the one hand, I was like, well, this is obviously a clear growth and extension strategy. It's also could also be a great way to introduce kids into the brand at a young age, it's true. Like the Disney strategy.
Exactly.
Right? Also playing off the fact that, you know, there's so much brand love from parents or people who love cycling that they want to get their kids. But at the other hand, I thought, well, is that a risk of potentially diluting the brand as well?
No, I think it potentially, but I don't think we ever saw. I mean, again, I think the kids' bikes, the offering is relatively small in the grand scheme, but they're kind of in, you know, in the right spots, in particular around kind of Strider bikes and mountain bikes. And I think that's the area where it's still most like playing, right? Or bikes to get to school. And you're exactly right. I think we want to deliver incredible stuff that answered their needs that also allowed them to kind of, you know, their first bike should be a Specialized. And so I think the opportunity there, the concerns for dilution, and it was a really interesting time. Cause like when I walked in, you know, we had a single I Am Specialized Instagram account, for example, and then just made the decision, strategic call to have a mountain bike versus a tri versus a road and still keep the parent. But we realized like, if you really only love mountain biking, all of the noise that we were talking about, road or otherwise, was gonna not, you know, wasn't gonna connect with you. And if it was too much, could be off-putting, you know? And so I think that was the area where we started to see not every category needed its own sort of access or point of communication, but you know, there's three or four clear ones where you're like, that's like, I might dabble and see what's going on the tour if I'm, you know, once in a while, but I only really want to see Matty Hunter riding with his kid, you know? And so, that was the bigger area of how do we not dilute the brand by pollinating and polluting people's with stuff that that's not how Specialized speaks to them. So
everything you did, talking about disruption, then everything that you've done then has sort of then led you to the place where you're today now at Lodge, which is a really, really fascinating story. So give it a little bit of the background of the of the company and the brand and how you ended up there?
It's it's great. The gentleman who started it, it's a guy named Kale Jennenbacher, and he in 2017 had recently got his MBA, and before that went to West Point and spent, you know, 5 years in the military and active duty, and you know, had fallen in love with the outdoors. And as a kid from the Midwest, he didn't have a ton of experience mountain biking or climbing, or and so kind of realized like the outdoors and the outdoor community isn't always the most welcoming. You know, there's always this sort of like, you know, sniff test, like, if you don't know what you're talking about, maybe you're not welcome. And wanted to also, you know, he often jokes that he camped for a living in the Army. And so didn't want to camp, but didn't want to be 45 minutes or an hour away from the trailhead that he was going to. And so that's really where Lodge Camp started, with the very first one in on the Washington coast in a cold water surf destination. 2017, fast forward a few years, global pandemic, really difficult for a upstart, small little network. And so I give him full credit for making it out the other side of that, as a small hospitality brand. So what we're doing now, is expanding relatively quickly with this idea that our job and our purpose is to make it easy for people to connect, to get out and to explore, and opening the outdoors for the most serious of outdoors people, with some of the comforts of community and, you know, a warm bed and a hot shower, or for what I often call the outdoor curious, people who just need the right kind of invitation or a hand up to get out and give it a try. Because, you know, ultimately, the outdoors is, I think we all believe, is life-changing, right? It's time well spent, whether it's by yourself or with your family or community. So that's what we're looking to do, and we just happen to do it through hotels, is kind of how we often say it, is change people's lives through the outdoors. I think we have 17 properties, of which 6 are open right at the moment. We'll be announcing more very soon. It's a funny conversation because I've never worked in hospitality, short of waiting tables and growing up in bars and restaurants that my dad owned as a kid. And that's a huge learning curve for me, which is super fun. But at the same time, you know, my boss's words are like, hey, we're an outdoor brand who just happens to be in the hospitality industry. So in that sense, it gave me a ton of comfort of like, how can we be agnostic to all things outdoors and make it more people welcome and build a really passionate, service-based community that can kind of continue to build and grow.
So is the core of it to drive people to those properties that you mentioned, or are there other aspects about the experience?
There's other aspects. And so first off, we typically go into great mountain towns, whether it's Bend or it's, you know, Leavenworth, Washington. So 2 to 4 hour drive time, because we know that not everybody's going to get to, you know, spend 10 grand and go to Europe this summer for 3 weeks. They're going to look for little mini vacations. And there are people who, you know, a lot of those towns are great activity towns, whether it's surf, ride, ski, paddle, whatever the case may be. So we start there. And then, instead of having lobbies, we have bars and cafes. And so like, how do we create spaces for people, whether they're on holiday or they're going to kind of work remotely and go ski for half a day and take care of work? So great Wi-Fi, great coffee, great beer is a great unifier. And then we also have expanded and created this gear offering. So, you know, not everybody has a bike. And so back to Specialized, we just recently announced that we're partnering with Specialized at every one of our locations. So kids bikes, town bikes, and certainly, you know, you can get a stump jumper in Bend by the end of this week, which is great. And so it gives you a chance to try things. And so that's, we talk a lot about, how can we be purveyors of, you know, outdoor stoke and allow people to come and be really at home if they're doing, something that they love. Sorry for the noise. Or try something different. So you might float the river, go for a mountain bike, take some trekking poles and try 3 or 4 different things in a single stay. And giving that unlock to people of the power of the outdoors is is, I think, really central to what we're doing.
Where could you see this being in 3 to 5 years?
The opportunity seems pretty big. The kind of outdoor hospitality space is definitely, showed itself, I think, through the pandemic, and we're seeing a ton of energy as we go. And we're seeing that through growth and, and a number of competitors coming out as well. I think we'll be both coasts by early 24. So with some properties on the East Coast that we've already acquired and we're in development in. I mean, ultimately, I think the business has a chance to be really meaningful at a number of, kind of property level across North America. And then, in 3 to 5 years, I would suspect that, we've already heard there's a lot of resonance, whether it's throughout Asia and Japan, through South America and otherwise. And so I'm hopeful that we'll have a really, excited. Again, it's kind of funny because we're talking about a hotel brand, and a lot of times we travel, I'm sure you travel a lot, and like, that's fine, but it's, it doesn't connect with you. And I think that's what that notion of connection and creating that with our hosts, but more importantly with other people who are there for the same reason you are, is I think going to be something that's going to, we're banking on that providing dividends as you go through, right? Community is something we all seek.
But you're building, you're building and owning and operating. So it's different in some ways to some of the big, to the hotel brands who essentially license, right? They essentially own the brand and, but they have operators or licensees essentially who take on all the real estate risk.
We're evolving that a little bit. We definitely have completely wholly owned, but then we are working with partners, 100% own the brand and the kind of guest experience. And so that's where we are. But, I saw something the other day. There was like hotel chain, and we're the furthest thing from a hotel chain. We're not a stamp. If you go to Mount Shasta, California, it's going to be very different than if you go to, Missoula, Montana, because it needs to take the form and the shape of not only the town that we're in, but the activities. And then again, we're working with local outfitters. Like, we're not going to be everything to all people. We've got our focus. And so, what's a great food or great coffee or great beer? How do we push people out? If you just come, we're not Club Med. If you just come and stay with us and don't get out and enjoy the community, then we think you're missing out on the experience. And then take that down to how do we work with local nonprofits who are based in those communities that can give back and maintain or update the land or the trails. And so those are a few of the other tent poles that are really important to us is that give back notion. We want to be contributing to the communities that we're a part of. And that includes, the locals as well as the people who travel in. So helps shape our focus and strategy.
What's the biggest challenge right now?
The biggest challenge of 23 has been just the state of the financial markets, if I'm honest, and so funding and funding at a real estate level and kind of those partnerships, it's been dry. I think as you and I are talking right now, there's an announcement going out that today that we landed a pretty healthy round of investment, which is great. That's going to unlock a lot of things. And so that's the biggest challenge. I think the other is just, that lives are busy and competing and encouraging people to go outdoors and put a little work in versus just, a relaxing holiday where everything's set for you. I think will always be a bit of a challenge. But again, knowing your audience, we know that there are people who are super passionate, from young children and families to, recently retired for the activities they love to do. And so it's just going to be, how do we take this brand, which has been Pacific Northwest predominantly, and find a way to really connect in a legitimate and meaningful way with expansion? And then how do we keep true to ourselves, right? I think that's always the thing, is how do you can continue to grow but not lose? And so that's where, again, if the word chain ever finds its way into our vernacular, we've lost. We're this connected network that all has similar, it kind of goes back to our same conversation, that is going to feel like Lodge, but is distinct in its kind of place in which it sits, right? So Vermont's going to be different than, again, Bend, Oregon, because it should be.
That's super interesting. So let's finish with a few questions.
Okay.
So just some of your leadership background. What are some of the leadership principles that you say are core to how you build and manage teams?
Or I actually have, I think at some point I created this notion of four T's and, five T's. Trust, how do you empower and encourage people and give trust and build it? Time, it takes a lot of work. I've often joked at people who say they just want to really start managing people in interviews that I've done, because a part of me goes, do you know what that actually means? But how do you give time and to help grow people, and how do you be present, which isn't always easy, right? As you're trying to work through. Where are your opportunities to teach? So, you know, there's ways that, you know, you can challenge, and how do you create the right kind of tension? Transparency. I think that's something that's really difficult to do a lot of times, but, you know, how can you be clear and consistent, inclusive and direct? I personally have always been probably more direct than, you know, than not. And then I often think about it as, you know, how can you be Teflon is the fifth T. So part of your job is to be a barrier for a lot of the and nonsense that's just real in this space, and you know, kind of further to that, then how does that allow you open space for people to grow and show you what, you know, what maybe you didn't think of? And so that's been sort of one of my philosophies on leadership throughout that I've sort of built, and I think it starts with the idea of, like, you really need to care for what you're doing and who you surround yourself with. And I think that's one of the things that's been really important to me is the people who still call me from companies that I'm no longer with, just to kind of get an opinion or a point of view. And I see that as one of my greatest sort of, like, achievements, if you will.
We were both talking earlier how much we both sort of admired Coach Prime, Deion Sanders.
Yeah.
And his openness to saying, you know, that they really got their butt kicked when playing against your alma mater.
Yes, Oregon.
I want to move past that very, very quickly.
Fair.
But what's in that spirit? What's one of the moments, or can you remember a time when you really got your butt kicked in a work setting? Mm-hmm. And what did you learn from that? How did you sort of come out stronger?
There's so many moments, right? We fall down more than we sort of rise, I think, oftentimes. And that's, you know, I'm reading a great book right now by Angela Duckworth called Grit, which is, you know, which I think is helpful in so many ways as a person, as a father, as a, you know, certainly in business. We talked a little bit about that photo behind me of Lauren Fleshman. That was one of those great moments where we went to Lauren with this concept and we said, we want you to do this. And she literally, and she actually wrote about this in her book called Run Like a Girl. You know, she's like, absolutely not. Like, that is not an idea. That's not a good one anyways. And so I give her full marks and a ton of respect, because she said, no, why don't we talk about it and find a different way? And so, like, you know, I was an ad manager at the time. And so that, obviously, my bosses found out, like, why didn't you sell the idea, Slate? And I was like, well, she's not wrong, actually. And so it just reinforced, like, when you've got somebody who brings the same amount of passion, whether they be an athlete or an everyday or whatever, really listen and then go and fight, you know, for what's right. And that ultimately, again, that poster, I still meet women today who were girls who said, oh, I had that on my wall as a kid, you know? And so that was a pretty good one. I've learned many more lessons because I'm a slow learner sometimes, but that was one that definitely stands out in my life.
Well, Slate, it's been the hour that we've had has absolutely flown by. Really appreciate you being on. It's been a great conversation and really
thank
insightful.
You very much. Hey, it's been awesome talking to you, and I appreciate the invite. I don't know what I don't know sometimes, and so it's always great learning from people like you.
That's all for today's episode. We hope these insights from top brand leaders help you as you face your own branding roadblocks. Remember that you're not alone in the challenges you face. and there are always impactful, creative, and human ways to solve brand problems. If you would like to further connect with fellow elite brand leaders and join our community, send an email to gcohen@monogle.com. Thank you for joining us. See you on the next one.